One of the shared moons did have an atmosphere and the beginning of a thriving bacteria biosphere. There had even been a research station above the pair for about 60 years. It was long gone now. The derelict wreckage dropped into the pair 20 years ago. But Aurelius had remained. A central system on the Commonwealth's spinward flank, where the Terrans ran up against the League, the pair offered a prime opportunity for refueling, and the shared collection of moons included some easily accessible transuranics. So the Terran Commonwealth Navy had used the Aurelius pair as the anchor for a semi-covert supply depot. It wasn't a fleet base, lacking in any ability to refit or repair ships, but it had stockpiles to resupply munitions, food, fuel, anything a ship patrolling the border or entering League space could need. "The Aurelius system, people," Kyle told them. "I hope everyone's reviewed the files Ostrovsky gave us. Officially, it's here to support Navy patrols on their spinward frontier. In practice, this is the main basing facility for every covert and black op the Terrans launch into the League."
"Are they sending a lot of those?" Chownik asked.
"Enough," Glass replied.
"Certainly, Dictator Periklos claims that the League was funding and arming his enemies to prevent the League getting truly solidified. It would be consistent, especially given that Periklos was armed and funded by the Commonwealth to remove a planetary government that was being uncooperative to Terran interests. The League is big enough and just barely unified enough to be too big of a pill for the Committee on Human Unification to set their eyes on just yet," the spy continued. "Periklos increasing that unity, whatever the galaxy thinks of his methods, is the exact opposite of what Terra wants. They've been trying to destabilize the League for a century."
Kyle smiled mirthlessly.
"A history of mutual aggravation our mission is intended to ignite," he admitted to his staff. "The League is as large as the entire Alliance. We have better tech and are better organized, but they're still the second largest single polity in human space. Adding them to our corner could change the entire course of this war." "Which brings us back to Aurelius," he continued. "The Condottieri and pirates know it has to exist, but most of them don't have Ostrovsky's data. They've been surprisingly successful at keeping it covert. Doing so, however, has required them to keep the warship presence in the system surprisingly light. According to the schedule we've bought, there are warships in the system less than half of the time." The hologram zoomed in on the pair at his mental command, highlighting the collections of platforms in high orbit of the two gas giants. "My main concern with his data, however, is that it's very clearly wrong on the defenses," Kyle said quietly, highlighting four of the 12 platforms and a scattering of satellites. "The data shows two Zion-class fighter defense platforms, hosting 100 scimitars between them, maybe a few missile satellites, but no further defenses. CIC has identified four Zion-class platforms and about 60 mixed defensive satellites, missile launchers, and lance platforms. That's a lot of firepower, people. More than Chameleon can handle in a straight-up fight. But we're flying a Q-ship for a reason. We have 2 days before I plan on kicking off the attack. Let's see if we can find a way to get the supplies we need without losing anyone." Before Hui Xing, the brainstorming would have been useful, but he'd have had a plan to start from. Now he didn't trust his own plans. The first strike, shock and awe, aggressive tactics he'd used earlier in his career had pulled him into a trap there that had almost got his entire command wiped out. He still had the instinct, but he didn't trust it. Part of him wanted to go full bore, bluff their way as close as they could under a TCN shipping ID, and do to the Zions what another Terran Q-ship had done to the main station in the Hessian system at the start of the war. Blow them apart with lances at close range. If they could pull it off, they'd knock out the main defenses, destroy the control center for the defensive satellites, and launch their assault shuttles and starfighters at point-blank range to secure the rest of the depot. It would be a very Stellar Fox plan.
but the man who'd once rammed a battleship found himself unable to trust his instincts. The door to Kyle's office chimed softly, informing him that someone was requesting admission. It was late enough that the ensign who would normally be holding down the door and screening his appointments was gone, sent off to his well-deserved rest from playing captain's watchdog. His implant informed him that Mr. Glass was outside, holding what looked like a paper bag, of all things. They didn't have a scheduled meeting. Kyle was up late going over the plan they'd put together for the Aurelius system, but he was content with what his staff had put together. With a thought, he opened the door and waved the spy in.
"Have a seat, Agent Glass," Kyle told the older man with an expansive wave. "What can I do for you?"
"The ship seems oddly quiet tonight," Glass said softly. "I feel like I'm walking through a library. Is this normal?"
"When we're going into battle? It depends," the captain replied. "If you think it's too quiet, go visit the flight deck lounge or the marine barracks. More than enough noise there for anyone."
"I'll pass," the spy said dryly.
"Here, peace offering."
He opened the paper bag and pulled out two tumblers, a small cooler of ice, and a dusty black bottle.
"This came all the way from Earth, one of six bottles I bought in Scotland a very long time ago," the spy said quietly. "It's not the last, and it's been opened before, but I don't share this with a lot of people. You saved my life on Giudecca Station."
Glass dropped several ice cubes into each glass and then poured a generous two fingers of amber liquid over them before sliding a glass gently across the table. Kyle took it carefully, sniffing at the unfamiliar scent.
"I think we both saved each other's lives," he pointed out. "That was very nearly a complete disaster."
"And you and your people got us out of it," Glass replied.
He offered his glass to Kyle, and they clinked together.
"L'chaim!"
The amber liquid went down like smooth fire, and Kyle coughed.
"Scotch whiskey," Glass told him. "Castle's version is evolved from what used to be called rye whiskey. Quite a different drink after a few hundred years."
"So I see, Agent.
Please, call me Nick," the spy replied. "It's even my real name, which we both know Glass isn't."
They sipped the whiskey in silence for a long moment, Kyle studying the hologram of the Aurelius system.
"I have to ask," he said after a moment. "Trickster said something about dropping a space station into a gas giant. What happened?"
Glass chuckled, shaking his head.
"That was a long time ago," he pointed out.
"Back when I had hair.
The war was barely over. A lot of people in the Commonwealth were surprisingly angry at the Alliance, for all that we really didn't put the screws on as much as some wanted."
The Alliance had forced the Commonwealth back to the status quo as of the opening of the war, and demanded that they help repair the systems they'd damaged. It had hardly been a new treaty of Versailles, but you wouldn't know that from the way the Commonwealth media talked about it even now.
"We were deep into Commonwealth space on an intel gathering op," Glass continued. "The ship basically was a freighter. Half the crew didn't know any of us were spies. We were hauling real, legitimate cargo. And we were recording everything we saw with high-powered passive scanners and buying intel from people like Trickster and Ostrovsky. I first met them both back then, though neither was as big a deal 20-odd years ago. Trickster was in system when this went down, which is probably why they remember it so vividly, and yes, they already had the mask and the name then. We were dealing with the Tetragrammaton mob at the time. They had a few facilities scattered around the place, but they wanted to do a physical handover of the data and the payment at a cloud scoop they were running way out in the outer system."
The old man shook his head.
"It was, of course, a trap. They'd sold us out to Commonwealth Intelligence, and we were ambushed by TCMC commandos."
He shivered at an unseen memory.
They make Riley's people look soft and fleshy. Half the crew might not have known we were spies, but the other half were some of the Federation's best, he continued. We had our pick of veterans after the war ended, hard men and women who'd forgotten how to do anything else. The commandos had machinery. We had experience. We got off the station and back onto the ship, much like the mess on Judeca.
He took a large swallow of the whiskey, forcing Kyle to wait for a moment.
Then, well, we had a station full of people who'd betrayed us, and Commonwealth commandos. The captain was dead. I was left in charge, and we had a small anti-missile suite to make sure we could run if we needed to. We shot out the stabilizers and pushed with the ship as we broke free. He finished simply.
Kyle winced. Normally, the stabilization rockets and mass manipulators aboard a space station were an unneeded safeguard. They might fire once a year or so, mostly to counteract the impact of docking ships. With all of them gone, however, an attached ship could easily throw the station into an unstable orbit.
My understanding is that they got almost everybody off, Glass noted after a moment. It wasn't a fast fall, after all. But they were far too busy to chase us after that.
Chapter 23. Aurelius System. 1200, June 5th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon. The Q-ship emerged from Alcubierre Stetson Drive in the normal flash of Cherenkov radiation, at the edge of the zone where the Aurelius pair's gravity rendered warping space dangerous. Their emergence point had been chosen carefully, with the depot platforms 20 million kilometers away and currently hidden by the closer of the two gas giants.
Echo Squadron launching, Taylor reported crisply.
The ship shivered slightly as seven of the fighter launch tubes fired, the hatches sliding shut to cover and conceal their presence as more fighters were slid into their place. With no engines active and their heat sinks running on maximum, Kyle was actually impressed by how hard the Black Ops fighters were to detect. They were visible from this close, but with their dark coatings and small size, they should actually be able to sneak up on the depot.
Good luck, Flight Lieutenant Tomasino, Kyle told the senior lieutenant in command of the squadron.
We'll see you on the other side, Captain, the pilot replied.
As the fighters spilled away solely under the velocity imparted by the launch tubes, Lau silently brought up Chameleon's own engines, accelerating toward the depot at the 100 gravities the Troubadour J freighter she looked like could manage. 2.5 hours, though it would probably be a lot sooner before they were challenged by the depot's defenders. Those four Zion platforms worried Kyle. If their flight groups deployed, this attack was over. A rapid and inglorious retreat back to League space would be their only option. Aurelius wouldn't be vulnerable to this style of attack again.
10 minutes until we clear Aurelius 4B and have visual,
Chownik noted from the CIC.
Scanners don't show any probes or satellites covering the blind spot. They should be here. I'm worried about our sensors, Captain.
Are we talking our sensors might not be the best intelligence could find after all, or there's a leftover Terran virus that's intentionally screwing with us?
Kyle asked with an only somewhat forced grin.
Because I'm not buying either explanation.
His exo was silent for a moment.
I just can't believe they wouldn't cover the blind spot on the other side of the gas giant, the cyborg pointed out. It seems reckless.
Remember that we are in Commonwealth space, Glass pointed out from the uncomfortable observer's seat at the back of the bridge.
This is a base whose existence is classified as well. They feel safe here. If Ostrovsky hadn't been amenable to large amounts of cash, they should have been safe here.
It's arrogant, Exo, Kyle told him. Not reckless. Are we seeing any blips, or are we fully clear?
Nothing, he admitted. I'm going to sit back here and babysit the analysis computers, though, just in case. It's too easy.
Please do,
Chameleon's captain confirmed. I agree. The door is way too open.
As they rounded the edge of Aurelius 4B, they got their first look at the depot that wasn't a month old. Everything they saw now was still a minute old, but that was practically real time compared to Ostrovsky's intelligence or their own light-month-out scans. Kyle concealed a sigh of relief as their view confirmed the promised lack of any starships. Even their current plan would have been in trouble if there had been a TCN warship present despite the schedule. Everything else looked much the same as it had a month before. Four Zion platforms orbited in a protective square above the single large station and dozens storage pods that made up the storage depot itself. A single squadron of 10 starfighters orbited above them, and Kyle inhaled sharply as the data processed. The 10 ships weren't scimitars. They were katanas.
Confirm those starfighters' IDs, he snapped.
Double-checked, triple-checking now,
Chownik responded from CIC.
Data checks out. The patrol squadron are definitely katanas. Do we abort?
No,
Kyle replied instantly. They could still abort, though it would be obvious what they'd done.
If everything works, Echo will still take them by surprise.
If they didn't, he'd just sentenced 21 men and women to death unless he could pull off a miracle.
No signal from them?
He asked aloud. No one else needed to know what was going through his head. They had to trust that the captain would get them through.
None yet, Taylor confirmed. We've been in their line of sight for 5 minutes. They're late.
REMFs, Kyle said with a chuckle. Terran REMFs at that. Let me know the instant those starfighters move.
They'd been in system for 45 minutes and in view of the depot for over half an hour before the first response from the Terrans arrived.
I'm getting a ping for our QCOM ID codes, Taylor reported. Nothing else, just the automated handshake request.
She glanced back at Glass.
Can we use our Terran quantum blocks?
We have them for a reason, the spy told her. The system will mark which ones we use today. We'll have to dump them after this is over. Try not to use too many up.
Understood,
the tactical officer said slowly.
Pinging them with the ID for one of the blocks.
How do I look?
Kyle asked as he tossed his uniform jacket aside, glancing back at the spy. His shipsuit was unmarked.
You need the hat,
Glass replied.
Terran merchant marine captains are never seen without it in their official capacities. Ever.
With a sigh, Kyle grabbed the high-peaked white cap from where he'd hung it on the end of his chair's arm and settled it neatly on his head. In his opinion, no sensible spaceborne organization, military or civilian, would insist on something so useless as a hat in space. But despite current appearances, he was not a Terran merchant marine captain. It was 5 more minutes after they'd responded to the QCOM request before the depot staff finally made contact. Taylor connected the channel, though, as soon as it was active, showing an extremely pale-skinned man whose hair had been shaved off in favor of a clearly, permanently attached cap of circuitry. He wore the red-sashed black uniform of the Terran Commonwealth Navy with 2 gold bars at his throat.
Unidentified civilian ship, this is Commander Roger Lafferty at the Aurelius Navy Depot. You are not on our shipping schedule. Please identify yourself and state your reason for approaching the depot.
Lafferty sounded like this was the most exciting thing that had happened to him in weeks, and he still didn't find it particularly interesting. How many months, Kyle wondered, had the man been stranded at this backwater base?
Aurelius Depot, this is the registered TMM freighter Historic Ideal, Captain John Sheridan commanding,
Kyle told the Navy officer.
We have a cargo of munitions and food supplies we were told to deliver here. I didn't even know there was anything here.
I'm sorry, you're not on our shipping schedule and I can't authenticate you,
Lafferty told him in a bored voice.
You're going to need to turn around and leave the system immediately.
Stand by to fake an engine malfunction,
Kyle told Lau via an implant channel,
then turned his best, obsequious smile back on the depot officer.
"I can transmit you our instructions," he told Lafferty. "I don't understand the problem. We were looking for work in the Corsica system and were offered this job."
He paused, injecting a hopefully carefully measured amount of panic and distress into his voice.
"Sir, I went a week out of my way to come here at the Navy's request. If I don't get paid for this delivery, I may not make the next note payment on Ideal. Please!"
Kyle could watch the conflict on the Terran officer's face between the urge to be a petty tyrant and the urge to help a fellow spacer out. It was a shorter struggle than he'd expected from the initial interaction, and Lafferty sighed.
"Look, I'll follow up with Logistics Command and see if I can find your orders," he said finally. "For now, you can maintain your course, but do not approach within 1,000,000 kilometers of the station without further authorization, or my standing orders give me no choice but to fire on you. Understand?" "I understand, Commander," Kyle told him. "Thank you, thank you."
And with the notorious speed, or lack thereof, of Commonwealth Navy Logistics Command, he might just make it all the way to that 1,000,000 kilometer mark, which was even better than they'd been counting on. Russell Rocco stood in Chameleon's primary flight control center, watching the ship inch toward its destination. He had one squadron, Alpha, in their birds and in the tubes. The rest of his flight crews waited in various lounges and quarters around flight deck. It was always a tough call for the CAG as to when to have the rest of the crews mount up. Chameleon had just made turnover and was still 75 minutes from the depot. At 10,000,000 kilometers, Roberts could technically order the launch of the starfighter wing at any moment. That wasn't the plan, and Russell glanced at the icon marking the estimated progress of Echo Squadron. It would be another 40 minutes before the plan called for them to launch, but the plan hadn't expected Katanas at the facility. He spotted Cavendish standing at the edge of the room, carefully watching the massive central hologram to see where her people were. He felt the moment of guilt at sending her squadron, hell, even her starfighter, into action without her. But it faded quickly. He still didn't trust her to follow orders in action, and he needed to know Echo Squadron was going to do their part today. He sympathized with her, but he was still glad he wasn't going to have her at his back with gigaton range warheads. Standing in the middle of the room, Russell himself was clearly visible to everyone. After a few moments, Cavendish crossed over to stand next to him.
"You're going to get my people killed," she hissed. "This whole op is suicide at this point."
"Not your call, Commander," he said levelly. "Not my call, either. We came here to do a job, and we're going to do it. I would have thought that a Black Ops pilot would get that if anyone did."
She glared at him for a moment, then turned her gaze on the hologram.
"I get it," she said slowly. "But you've hung my entire squadron out to dry. Their stealth isn't that good. No stealth is in space."
"There's a plan," Russell told her. "Tomasino knows it. I know it. The captain knows it. And if anyone can improvise their way out if the plan starts coming apart, it's Roberts."
"So I should just have faith? Is that what you're telling me?" she demanded. "I'm not good at that."
"Look to the stars," he said gently. "I, however, have a battle to fight."
Stepping away from the grounded flight commander, he raised his voice.
"All right, people, this is it. Drop 'em and load 'em. I want all squadrons on ready status in 5 minutes."
Chapter 24. Aurelius System. 1330, June 5th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon.
"All squadrons are fully manned, armed, and standing by," Rokos reported over the intercom. "We are clear to deploy on your order, Captain."
"Thank you, CAG," Kyle replied, pausing to validate the data on the fighter squadrons. They were carrying a full load of the most advanced Sarissa fighter missiles the League manufactured, a surprisingly capable weapon that he suspected actually had better electronic warfare penetrators than the current generation Alliance or Commonwealth weapons.
Chameleon was decelerating toward a point exactly 1,000,000 kilometers away from the depot. In about 20 minutes, Taylor would deploy her single salvo of capital ship missiles as stealthily as possible, ready to fire a time-on-target salvo with Echo Squadron's missiles. The stealth fighters would come around the far side of Aurelius 4B with enough velocity to give them 1,000,000-kilometer range, a surprise launch that, combined with Chameleon's handful of Terran-built Stormwind missiles, should take out the four launch platforms and leave the single squadron of starfighters facing all of Rokos's people. Those were odds at which Kyle was comfortable asking Cataphract Ds to face down seventh-generation space superiority starfighters. "Any word from Echo Squadron?" he asked. All of the starfighters had been refitted with QCOMs equipped with Federation-entangled particle blocks before they'd left. It meant the ships could not be allowed to fall into Commonwealth hands, but that was true regardless.
"On schedule as of the last pulse," Taylor confirmed. The QCOM might not be interceptable, but its use was detectable at several 100,000 kilometers if someone was paying attention and had the right sensors. So instead of a full telemetry feed, Chameleon was receiving short text updates, minimizing the amount of time the QCOM was engaged. 25 minutes to launch. 40 until the Q-ship could reach the depot. Timers ticked away both in Kyle's implant feeds and on the screens and holograms around him. So far, despite the wrinkle of facing katanas instead of scimitars, everything was proceeding according to plan. Kyle had barely finished that thought, of course, before everything came apart.
"We've been made!"
Flight Lieutenant Tomasino's voice suddenly echoed across the bridge as Echo Squadron linked back in.
"There's a flight of katanas flying a security patrol, and they blundered right into us!"
With the squadron's stealth broken, full telemetry slammed back into the bridge, holograms and tactical plots updating in real time with the scans from the squadron of starfighters on the other side of the gas giant. The acting squadron commander hadn't waited for orders to engage. The four katanas had managed to get within 100,000 kilometers before realizing they weren't alone, and 21 missiles were already closing the gap at 1,000 gravities. The range was short enough, there was no way the katanas could evade the missiles, but long enough that they launched their own birds. 16 Javelin fighter missiles closed on Echo Squadron even as their discoverers died in balls of antimatter fire. The plan was broken. Without the surprise salvo from Echo Squadron, there was no chance of taking out the launch platforms with missiles. That plan had always relied on the fact that it would take at least 5 minutes for the squadrons aboard the Zions to go from regular shifts to launching. But there were options, and Kyle was giving orders before he had time to doubt himself.
"Tomasino, abort and break away," he snapped. "Flash them your full drives, but dive into the gas giant. Play ghosts."
"You want bait," the flight lieutenant said grimly, the icons of his fighters on the screen bracketed by explosions as they took out the incoming missiles. For all that Kyle knew the experience level of his Space Force pilots better, Cavendish's crews were still veterans, and Javelins without ECM support from their motherships were child's play.
"Bait and a stalking horse," Kyle confirmed. "Keep their eyes looking for you, but not at the price of your squadron. Understood?"
"I think so," the pilot replied. He paused for a long moment, the silence making it clear that he, at least, understood the odds at making it out of this with his entire squadron.
"Make it worth it, Captain."
"I will," he promised, turning back to Taylor.
"Jenny, would a deaf and blind merchant ship have seen those explosions yet?"
he asked her distractedly, studying the tactical plot in the hologram.
35-plus gigaton range explosions?" she asked.
Despite her flippant response, she was clearly running the numbers.
"Yes," she noted. "A few seconds ago now."
"Link me back to Lafferty," Kyle ordered, replacing the stupid high-peaked cap on his head.
A moment later, the QCOM channel reopened. This time, Lafferty looked significantly more stressed.
"What?"
he snapped.
"We just picked up antimatter explosions,"
Kyle replied in his best panicked civilian voice.
"What's going on, Commander?"
"I don't fucking know,"
Lafferty told him.
"A bunch of pirates just jumped one of our patrols, but we've no idea where they came from."
"Pirates?"
Kyle exclaimed.
Sir, Ideal is unarmed. We're helpless if there's pirates out here.
They're not on this side of the planet, the Terran officer told him. Maintain your current course. The exclusion zone is still in effect. We will fire on you if you break it.
The channel cut short, and Kyle smiled mirthlessly.
Do I sound panicked enough to push his exclusion zone? He said aloud.
Lau, adjust our course. Adjust our acceleration. I want us to swing right past the station at about 10,000 clicks with at least 100 KPS left. Doable?
Easy, the navigator replied. 3 5-minute intercept, 1 5 to exclusion zone.
20 minutes. Kyle would have to stall Lafferty for 20 minutes. The squadron of starfighters flying overwatch for the depot was moving by the time Kyle was done speaking to Lafferty, all 10 ships accelerating toward the site of the short battle at 500 gravities. As the seconds ticked away and Chameleon started accelerating again, two more squadrons of the new starfighters launched from the Zions, taking off after the first one. 30 Katanas. That was going to be a headache. Kyle found himself holding his breath, waiting for the second wave of launches. It should take 5 minutes for the other squadrons to prep and launch, almost the exact amount of time Lau's new course had the Q-ship accelerating before the new turnover point. No one at the depot even commented on the fact that the freighter was now accelerating toward them on a course that would take it into the zone where he'd been told they would fire. From his own experience, Kyle knew that even the most advanced intelligences and sensors still worked at the guidance of their human masters. Today, those human masters were focused on trying to find Echo Squadron and getting their starfighters deployed. The harmless freighter closing with the depot wasn't a factor in the situation, far from a threat. Chameleon made turnover, hurtling toward the space station while now decelerating away from them at 110 gravities, well inside the Q-ship's capabilities, but the kind of fuel consumption a freighter captain would only embrace if utterly terrified.
Do we deploy missiles, sir? Taylor asked as they crossed the range where the original plan had them launching.
Negative, he said quietly. Load the launchers, capital ship and fighter missiles alike, but keep the hatches closed. What's our lance range against the Zions?
The range in any given exchange of positron fire was a combination of the strength of the defender's electromagnetic deflectors, the power of the lance, and the actual size of the defender. It was easier for a 30-meter-wide starfighter's deflectors to generate a miss than for a kilometer-long starship's deflectors to do the same.
150,000 kilometers, Taylor paused, swallowing visibly. Are we going to get that close?
If they'll let us, gods, yes, Kyle told her with a wide grin, suddenly feeling comfortable in his bridge again.
At that range, those defense platforms will shred us when they open fire, she pointed out.
Yes. So when we shoot the Zions, you'd best not miss, he agreed.
The feed from Echo Squadron was nerve-wracking. The stealthy starfighters had sacrificed any attempt at concealment to try and open the distance from the Terran ships chasing them. Both groups of ships had much the same acceleration, but Echo had been heading toward the depot when the rocket had gone up. They had time, though. Tomasino was taking his squadron into 4B's atmosphere, a risky stunt that his veterans could handle, but that Kyle was willing to bet the pilots assigned to security at a supply depot on the opposite side of the Commonwealth from the major war weren't up to. Of course, given that the supply depot security wings had better starfighters than they expected, it was possible they had better pilots. If they did, though, the pilots were better than the rest of the crew. It was fully 10 minutes after his conversation with Lafferty before anyone seemed to notice that Chameleon was now on a course that would cross the 1 million kilometer line the Terran officer had ordered them to stay clear of.
What are you playing at, Sheridan?
Lafferty demanded as his shaven-headed image reappeared on Kyle's communication screen.
We're projecting your vector to bring you inside the no-fly zone. Break off immediately. We've picked up the pirates,
Kyle insisted back in a panicked voice, the voice of a man who might well be jumping at ghosts.
They're behind us. We need you to protect us. That's what the Navy's for. Damn it, man!
Seconds ticked by.
We don't see anything behind you,
the Terran officer finally said, his tone sympathetic.
I guarantee you, Captain Sheridan, there are no pirates on this side of the Aurelius Pear. Even at 1,000,000 kilometers, our starfighters can intercept any threat before they could reach you. You will be safe, so long as you follow instructions.
It had been 8 minutes. He needed to get closer. They were still 700,000 kilometers short of the no-fly zone, let alone lance range. Kyle paused, trying to give the impression of a hesitating captain while he opened an implant channel to Lau.
On my mark, give me 200 gravities deceleration for 3 seconds, then fake a blowout and kill the engines.
Visibly, he exhaled a sigh as if trying to regain control.
We will comply, he told Lafferty. Decelerating now.
He reached to cut the channel and stopped as he felt Lau's fake blowout throw the entire ship. He didn't want to know what his navigator had cooked up with engineering, but it was convincing to him. The Q-ship's acceleration cut to zero, and she continued to tremble as loose positrons slammed into the hull, triggering 1,000 tiny annihilation explosions.
My gods!
He swore aloud on the channel.
Our engines are down, Commander, he told Lafferty. I can't change course.
Without accelerating in any direction, Chameleon would blast past the depot at 10,000 kilometers distance and a velocity of almost 1,900 kilometers a second, well before the pursuing Katanas reached Echo Squadron.
We have your vector recorded,
the Navy officer said grimly. Kyle wondered where the commander's senior officer was. Lafferty was at most a shift commander. The depot's defenses should have been commanded by an 06 captain, or the 07 Commodore that would be equivalent to a Federation captain like Kyle. Though if it was a Commonwealth Starfighter Corps 07, a wing colonel, that would explain a lot. If Lafferty hadn't bothered to wake up his superiors, that would also explain why no more fighter squadrons were in space. The Navy officer running the duty shift would only have the authority to call a full fighter scramble in the case of a direct attack.
We picked up the explosion, Lafferty continued. Advise immediately once your engines are back online. If you adjust vectors without permission at this point, we will blow you out of space. You will be boarded by a Marine contingent as you close. This isn't negotiable, Sheridan, he snapped as Kyle started to open his mouth. I'm sticking my neck out for you. Don't fuck it up.
I understand, Kyle said aloud. I'll be ready to meet your Marines as they board. The channel cut, and Kyle ran the numbers. Unless it took them far longer than was reasonable to get their Marines into space, they'd board before he was in lance range. Unfortunately for Lafferty, he had a solution for that.
Lieutenant Major Hansen, he said calmly as he raised the Marine CO. It looks like the Terrans are going to make work for you sooner than we thought.
Chapter 25, Aurelius System. 1350, June 5th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon. Edvard spared 4 of his precious seconds to curse out competent Terran officers. His entire company was locked into battle armor and loaded aboard their assault shuttles. He was ready to punch 180 of the Castle Federation's finest into the logistics depot, which meant he had no one in position to counter a boarding they had no choice but to allow.
They'll arrive in just over 8 minutes, Roberts told him. We're in lance range in 10, and launching your boarding shuttles in 11. I need 2 minutes, Hansen.
I'll get them for you, Edvard replied grimly.
Bravo, platoon. Disembark ASAP and move to the fake civvy boarding zone. Hustle, we're on the clock. Alpha, Charlie, stand by for the assault.
For several seconds, he hesitated, unsure which of the 2 operations his company was about to launch needed him. If the Terran Marines warned their bases what was coming, the assault would never happen. Everyone would be dead before his shuttles could launch. The battleship-grade lances on the remote-controlled platforms would see to that.
Riley, you're in charge of the assault, he ordered the Black Ops lieutenant as he used his implant to order the shuttle to release the heavy metal bars holding his battle armor in place. Keep me informed, but the strike is yours.
Understood, she replied.
Good luck.
I don't need luck, he said. I have Castle's damned Marines.
She gave him a soft wolf howl, a quiet version of the CFMC's terrifying battle cry, and dropped the channel.
Ramirez!
Edvard raised his gunny as he stepped off the shuttle, the ramp closing shut behind him on the people who would now be launching an assault without him.
We have jammers in inventory, right?
Of course,
the smaller man agreed, falling in beside him as they joined in the briskly moving column of armored Marines.
But we can't jam a QCOM.
Don't need to,
the lieutenant major told his NCO.
We need 2 minutes, Gunny, and the QCOM is on the shuttle, not in the trooper's armor.
Assuming they were feeling paranoid enough to show up in battle armor, it probably wouldn't change how this ended, but battle armor certainly had options that Marines in lighter armor didn't.
Meet me at the docking bay with the biggest, nastiest jammers we have in inventory, he ordered. And like I said, Gunny, we're on the clock.
A Navy chief petty officer was waiting for Edvard when he arrived at the docking bay in the fake civilian part of the Q-ship.
Are you greeting them?
The painfully skinny, red-headed woman demanded gruffly.
Unless you're shooting before talking, they'll need to see someone who looks like ship's crew.
The thought hadn't even crossed Edvard's mind. As usual, an informed, non-commissioned officer had found the hole in the plan. He checked the time. 90 seconds. The Terran shuttle was accelerating hard to match velocities. They weren't going to quite make it, and it was going to be a rough stop for the poor bastards aboard, something Edvard was relying on.
It's going to have to be me, he agreed, starting to issue the commands for his armor to unlatch. I can get out of the armor, but I don't have a merchant uniform.
Got them,
the chief told him with a smile, producing a white cap and jacket from her carry-all.
So long as you're wearing a ship suit, we should be good.
60 seconds. Edvard stepped out of his battle armor, ordering the suit to close up and move back out of sight on its own. Grabbing the jacket from the NCO, he glanced back at the Marines moving up.
This ship has false panels there and there, he ordered, pointing them to the accesses as he spoke. They'll cover you from standard passives. Get in there and wait. We need time more than we need dead Terrans.
40 seconds. He slapped the cap onto his head and turned back to the chief.
How do I look?
Like a lazy civvy. It'll do, she replied.
Who am I supposed to be?
XO, Merchant Marine Commander, she told him. No name on the uniform. Use your own. The captain is probably the only one the Terrans would recognize by name.
Thank you, Chief.
Polson, sir. Becca Polson,
she introduced herself, falling in behind him at a respectful distance as he approached the door. 20 seconds. The last of the Marines were out of sight, except for Ramirez and 2 Marines he'd recruited as pack mules. They were each carrying the bulky meter-and-a-half-tall cylinders of high-powered regional jammers.
Get in the compartments and get those set up, Edvard hissed. Hold them for my order.
10 seconds. There was no hesitation on the part of Ramirez and his mules as they bolted into the hidden compartments and sealed them. The Terrans were still 50 kilometers clear, the Q-ship's own hull sufficient to conceal the suits at that range. A wash of plasma slammed into the armored exterior of the docking bay as the assault shuttle desperately shed kilometers per second of relative velocity. She still slammed into the docking port at several hundred meters a second, a speed the shuttle was better designed to handle than the theoretically civilian port was. Edvard heard the metal crunch under the impact, but a quick implant interrogation of the systems showed the port was still fully functional. His momentary impulse to lock it down and claim it was jammed was rendered moot a second later as a series of override codes hit the Terran-built lock and forced it to open instantly. A 4-man fire team swept into Chameleon immediately, weapons sweeping the space as the Marines advanced. The Terrans wore light body armor, but not the heavy battle armor he'd been afraid of. One of them kept Edvard and Polson covered as the others moved forward. After about 5 seconds, a second wave of Marines entered. A fire team in battle armor escorted a hatchet-faced woman in the green lapelled black uniform of the Terran Commonwealth Marine Corps into the ship.
You are not Captain Sheridan, she snapped. Where is he?
I am Commander Hansen, Edvard replied, intentionally dragging out his speech to buy precious seconds.
Captain Sheridan is dealing with the engine failure. He asked me to meet with you. What do you need, ma'am?
My teams will examine your engines and bridge, she said bluntly, gesturing more people, these in the plain black utility ship suits of Navy ratings, off the shuttle. Any resistance will be met with lethal force. Step aside.
I can escort your people to the bridge, Edvard offered.
Suddenly the guns were focused directly on him, the muzzles suddenly very large.
I am not fooled, Hansen, the Marine said. Your ship arrives without proper orders at the same time as these pirates. You are working together. I will find out how and stop you.
40 seconds to lance range. Edvard was running out of time.
I'd like to assure you that nothing is further from the truth, he told her while ordering Ramirez to jam transmissions.
It would take more than 30 seconds for the shuttle to realize something was wrong, and that would be too late, quantum communicators or no.
Of course I can't, Edvard admitted with a mirthless smile,
as every non-quantum communicator inside 1,000 kilometers ground to a halt in a blaze of static. The access to the shuttle slammed shut in a faked malfunction, and the dozen Terrans found themselves staring down the weapons of 50 battle-armored Federation Marines.
Ve Victus, he told the Terran Marine.
Woe to the conquered, the unofficial motto of League Condottieri, who turned pirate.
Lay down your arms or die.
A half dozen fighters can't defeat these defenses, she snapped at him. You should be surrendering, not me.
0 seconds, and the Terran officer's face went white as she recognized the distinct, hair-tingling sensation of a powerful positron lance firing nearby. Kyle felt the Q-ship vibrate under him as the shuttle made contact with brutal force. That couldn't have been pleasant for the people aboard, and it was telling about the level of suspicion at least some people were applying to historic ideal. If the Marines were buying his spiel, it would have been far easier on everyone for them to match velocities and board as Chameleon passed the station.
100 seconds to range, Taylor said softly. Sir, they've trained one of the big Lance satellites on us. We have stronger deflectors than they do, but that's a megaton range beam. It will cut right through us.
Target it with the secondary beams, he ordered. Those satellites don't have any deflectors. In fact, target every defensive satellite you can without sacrificing your line on the Zions.
That won't be many, she warned. We're only going to have 2 Zions in our sights at a time, boss. The sequence is only going to take about 3 seconds to complete, but that's 3 seconds for someone to hit a button and ruin our day.
While the 4 main positron lances had some flexibility in their emitter angle, it wasn't nearly enough for them to hit all 4 stations in one salvo. It was enough for a 3-second rotation to bring all 4 Zions under Chameleon's guns.
Hit everyone you can, he ordered grimly, checking the time and distance.
30 seconds.
Charge the lances, stand by the missiles, clear the hatches at T-minus 10 seconds.
His tactical officer nodded absently, her mind and attention now completely locked into her system.
Lau, as soon as we fire, bring up the engines at maximum deceleration, he ordered. We need to launch Hansen's shuttles with as little relative velocity as possible. Chownik, watch those satellites, he concluded, glancing at the image of his XO in the Q-ship's CIC. Flag the ones most likely to hit us for Taylor.
On it,
the XO replied. His attention snapped back to the CIC main hologram as he spoke, though, and then he continued in a more urgent tone.
We have fighter launch. I've got another 10 katanas clearing Zion 3.
Too late, Kyle snapped. Taylor, take the targets from CIC. Drop your missiles on them.
10 seconds.
Clearing the hatches, she announced. Retargeting missiles.
Several seconds of silence followed, everyone on both the bridge and CIC immersed in the tactical network. This was the window of vulnerability. If someone spotted the weapon hatches opening and made the call to sacrifice their Marines, everyone aboard Chameleon would die today. Then the ship shivered slightly as they crossed an invisible line in space and Taylor opened fire. 4 half-megaton-a-second positron lances lit up Kyle's tactical plot,
the computer happily drawing them in as white lines for the 3/4 of a second they were on target. It was more than enough. The Zions were at combat readiness, with their deflectors at full power, but they hadn't actually been expecting an attack, and certainly not from Chameleon. 2 beams of pure antimatter struck each fighter launch station, the deflectors pushing the beams away from the center of the station, but not far enough to force a miss. Where the streams of positrons hit, they annihilated regular matter, ripping massive tears through the armor and hull. One of the beams on the first station hit one of the primary zero-point cells, ripping apart the carefully balanced magnetic tubes that pulled the positrons safely into storage chambers. The stream of positrons was weaker than Chameleon's weapon, but it was starting inside the station and didn't cut off after less than a second. By the time the zero-point cell itself came apart, the station was gone. The second station was luckier. There was no single critical hit to incinerate the entire structure, just 2 beams of pure antimatter that ripped through the station, shattering armor, corridors, weapons, and systems. It came apart in large enough pieces that there would be survivors, but it came apart in useless pieces nonetheless. As the Q-ship slewed in space, maneuvering thrusters firing at full power to spin the 400-meter sphere like a child's toy, the secondary lances opened fire. They were weak compared to those a true warship would carry, but they were still 50 kiloton a second beams, beams that ripped into starfighters and satellites alike with deadly force. The turn took a fraction under 2 seconds, and then Chameleon's lances lashed out again. The second pair of Zions was no luckier than the first, both coming apart under the sustained pounding of the Q-ship's main guns.
"Missiles in the air, sweeping the remaining stations with the lances," Taylor reported. "We have incoming starfighters!"
"Rokos!" Kyle snapped. "Alpha Strike, go!" Chapter 26. Aurelius System. 1405, June 5th, 2736, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Chameleon. Acceleration slammed Russell back into the seat of his command starfighter with crushing force as Chameleon flung the first wave of his ships into space. Ignoring the force as best he could, he surveyed the situation. 10 seconds earlier, 4 Zion-class defensive platforms, 10 Katana-class starfighters, and 60 defensive platforms had been orbiting above the Aurelius Logistics Depot. In 10 seconds, Taylor's surprise attack had shredded all 4 Zions and 4 of the Katanas.
"Katanas are launching," Alvarado reported.
24 missiles launched on Chameleon," he paused. 5 of the satellites have also launched, presumably under the Katana's control. 30 capital missiles incoming.
"All fighters, target the Katanas and launch 2 salvos, Rokos ordered. "Alpha, Bravo, stop the fighter missiles. Charlie, Delta, take the satellites' missiles."
He had Alpha Squadron and half of Bravo in space already, forming up around him as he led 10 fighters after 6. He left the missiles to Alvarado and the other gunners, trusting them to do their jobs, while he brought up the cataphract's upgraded positron lance and started tracking missiles. The Katanas clearly hadn't been expecting a fighter screen, their missiles pushing toward the Q-ship in a close echelon that concentrated the limited electronic warfare capabilities of the smaller missiles and protected them from a starship's defenses, but left them vulnerable to the starfighters that could get in close and generate multiple approach angles. His own people's missiles began to fill space as well, starting with 20 from his first launch, followed by 40 more as his second wave of starfighters deployed in time to join in. With 10 missiles in space for each Terran starfighter, he dismissed the Katanas and focused on their missiles. They, too, had a second salvo in space.
"Taylor got the missile satellites before they launched again," Alvarado told him. "Charlie is sweeping after those birds, and Delta will follow as they launch."
The whole thing was a close-range mess, with Chameleon's lasers and lances flashing past his ships as they closed on the incoming javelins. Missile flight times were barely a minute with the velocity Chameleon had imparted to them, and just to add to the mess, he could see the assault shuttles blasting away from the Q-ship behind him. He tracked across space, firing the lance in 10th-second bursts as he crossed the likely zones for the incoming missiles. 13 more of his starfighters did the same,
and the six katanas did the same against his missiles. Space started to get messy as missiles began to explode. First a handful, and then more and more as the two groups of fighters closed. The katana crews weren't the disorganized pirates they'd faced in New Edmonton. Their ECM linked together, defensive and offensive systems alike combining to make a hash of the scanners Russell was using to track their missiles. The explosions didn't help. Each missile killed erupted in a gigaton-plus explosion as both their warheads and antimatter fuel ignited, filling the space around them with high-velocity debris and hard rads. Each explosion added its own sphere of natural jamming to the chaos, helping cover their sisters as they closed. Russell's people were expecting it, accounting for it, and generating different sensor angles to see past and through the fireballs. The Katana pilots were not. They were probably trained for it. Their training was good, but training was no substitute for the harsh mistress of battle. The last of the first salvo of incoming fighter missiles came apart well over 50,000 kilometers short of Chameleon, nailed by Alpha 4's defensive laser clusters. Their own first salvo struck home, blasting half of the remaining katanas apart. Six had failed to stop 20 missiles. Three stood no chance against 40, and Russell turned his own starfighter back to hunt the remaining missiles heading for Chameleon.
"Damn it! They got through!"
The panicked voice of Charlie Squadron's commander suddenly echoed in his mental link as a new icon popped up onto the screen. A trio of capital ship missiles that hadn't been there a moment before and were now in a final lunge toward the Q-ship.
"They told them to play dead and let the radiation cloud cover them."
It was a trick Captain Roberts had taught his own people, and Russell had seen used half a dozen times, and at this range, it was devastatingly effective. None of his starfighters could attempt to intercept those missiles without endangering Chameleon themselves. It was down to the Q-ship's own defenses, the big ship spinning away from the incoming missiles as she began the terrifying defensive pirouette of a warship in the antimatter age. Lasers and positron lances flashed out in a desperate defense. Two missiles went down almost simultaneously, Taylor skillfully picking them off moments after they appeared, but creating new radiation clouds that hid the last missile as it dove across the last 10,000 kilometers. Chameleon vanished behind the explosion as the warhead closed the final distance, and then reappeared as the radiation faded.
"Chameleon, what's your status?"
Russell demanded.
"Nailed it 300 meters from the hull," Taylor responded after a moment. "We're shaken, but we're okay."
"Rokos, those other two squadrons are still hunting Echo," Roberts interrupted. "We've got the station. You know your mission."
"I do,"
the CAG confirmed grimly. Search and destroy, and hope like void they made it to Echo Squadron in time. Edvard had many unkind words to say about Terran Marines. That they lacked courage was not among them. The hum of the positron lances firing wasn't much of a distraction, but they tried to use it anyway. The battle-armored Marines opened fire on the squads flanking them as the officer and her first fire team charged at Edvard and Chief Poulsen. He was moving in the same instant they were, shoving the Navy NCO out of the line of fire as he scrambled backward. He didn't even try and draw his own weapon, trusting to his men to put the Terrans down. Even the four in battle armor weren't carrying anti-armor weapons. Their fire ricocheted off Bravo Platoon's armor and drew a response from troopers who were carrying such weapons. All eight of the Marines were down by the time their CO reached Edvard, his people realizing that he might want her alive. She was clearly planning to take him hostage, training her sidearm on his unarmored head and opening her mouth to shout a demand for his people to stand down. If it hadn't already been obvious that, determined as the Terran officer was, she was no veteran, that would have been enough. Edvard's bladed hand caught the pistol barrel, yanking it down as she fired into the floor. The Terran officer followed her gun downward and slammed full force into his suddenly rising knee. He felt a rib crack over his knee as she rotated around him and hit the ground, her suddenly broken arm trapped behind her as he pinned her to the floor.
"Congratulations, you just killed your men,"
he hissed in her ear,
giving orders over his implant for Ramirez and Bravo Platoon to seize the shuttle.
A lot of people are going to die today. You didn't need to add to the list.
Shuttle crew surrendered, Ramirez reported. What do you want us to do with them, boss?
Is the shuttle still flyable? Edvard asked, glancing over at Poulsen.
They didn't lock the controls. I guess they didn't want to lose fingers while I made them unlock them, the gunny replied.
Edvard pinged Poulsen by implant, making sure the Terrans, who had to think they were disorganized pirates, didn't hear him.
Can you fly it? He asked.
Yes.
Poulsen, get going with Ramirez, he ordered aloud, accepting her claim at face value. Leave Morris with the prisoners. I'm not letting the others get all of the loot.
Sergeant Morris commanded Bravo Platoon's 4th Squad. He was moving the Marines, techs, and flight crew who'd surrendered off the shuttle before Edvard had even finished speaking. Ramirez handed Edvard a pair of restraints he used to tie up the wounded Marine.
You get to live today, miss, he told her.
With that final barb landed, he turned to board their newly stolen shuttle. Despite the act he'd put on, the act that made leaving the Marine officer alive necessary, regardless of any disgust at shooting prisoners or idiots, he wasn't worried about the other two platoons stealing all of the loot. He was worried about sending two platoons against an entire space station. The near miss had left Chameleon feeling more than a little crispy to Kyle's senses. A good portion of the emitters and receivers for their long-range scanners and electronic warfare suite had been vaporized. Nothing that couldn't be fixed, given an average-size nickel-iron asteroid in about 36 hours, but enough to make him feel a touch more blind than he preferred.
Drop a Q-probe to back up our scanners, he ordered Taylor. With the fighters heading out to pull Echo out of the fire, we need to be seeing clearly.
That will only leave us 8 league-linked probes, she noted.
All quantum communicators linked through a switchboard station somewhere to offset the inherently point-to-point nature of the entanglement used. While Chameleon had some castle-linked QCOM probes in her storage bays, those would be far too easily traced back to the Federation. Given that a normal deployment could easily see 20 or 30 of the sensor drones scattered around a star system, only having 9, 8 after this, of them available made Kyle as twitchy as it did Taylor.
They're there to be used, he reminded her.
XO, let's see if we can get the hornet's nest we've kicked over to calm down. I don't suppose Lafferty is still around.
He was based on one of the Zions, Chownik noted after a moment's analysis. He might be alive, but he doesn't have access to a QCOM anymore.
That would have been too easy,
Kyle said cheerfully, studying the screen as the shuttles made their approach to the central station. He was taken aback for a moment to note the Terran shuttle returning with his people, but it turned out he had a message from Hansen explaining that. Shaking his head, he grinned broadly.
All right,
he said loudly, taking the Terran merchant marine cap off and hanging it off his chair at a hopefully rakish angle.
Get me a wideband, wide-angle transmission at the station.
You're on.
Aurelius Station.
He greeted his audience in the lazy, affected drawl of a condottieri captain.
This is Captain Sheridan of Historic Ideal. As you may have guessed by now, we are not what we appear to be. Given your pathetic lack of defenses, I now claim this system as my own. You will stand down and cooperate with my soldiers, or there will be hell to pay. You know the rules of the game. You lose. And Vae Victus.
He made a cut-off gesture and smiled.
Let me know if anyone responds. I presume we made sure their starfighters got that? Everybody in the system will get it, dependent on the speed of light,
Chownik promised.
Can't promise anyone is going to listen.
I can hope, Kyle said, a moment of seriousness slipping through his usual facade.
We just killed almost 3,000 people. I'd rather not add to the list if I don't have to.
Incoming response.
Link it to me, Kyle ordered.
A new image appeared on his screen. An older man with gaunt cheeks and graying black hair. Unlike Lafferty, he clearly hadn't bothered to put his full uniform on and was only wearing the black ship suit, with a single red fake lapel,
of the Terran Commonwealth Navy with the single star of a Commodore. The Federation had bumped captain to be the equivalent rank and slipped in senior fleet commander, justifying that an interstellar starship with 5,000 people aboard needed an O-7 in command.
"I am Commodore Arkwright, commanding officer of the Aurelius base,"
he said with a surprising amount of calm disdain.
"Am I speaking to the pirate, Sheridan?"
"Pirate?" Kyle asked in an offended tone. "Is that any way to speak to the man offering you your life?"
"You may have destroyed our defenders, but your flying junk heaps are no match for the Commonwealth's best,"
Arkwright told him.
"I assure you, Captain Sheridan, you are in no position to threaten my life."
"Your fighters are shiny, but your pilots are crap," Kyle replied conversationally. "Mine are veterans of a dozen battles apiece. Your glorified rookies stand no chance. Spare their lives, Commodore. Yield." For a moment, Arkwright looked hesitant, something breaking through the contempt on his face. But it was only a moment, and then the sneer returned in full force as he gazed down his long, aristocratic nose at Kyle.
"The Commonwealth has never surrendered to pirates," he snapped. "It will not start today."
"Well then," Kyle replied, concealing his own moment of hope between an equally contemptuous sneer. "Give my regards to my boarding troops. You'll be seeing them before I do."
"We are hitting heavy resistance," Riley reported as Edvard's commandeered shuttle blasted toward the station. "Disorganized so far, but they've got at least a company of Marines and they were paying attention to our approach vectors. We haven't hit armor yet, but the bastards have anti-armor gear."
"Send me everything you've got," the lieutenant major ordered. "We might be able to get in behind them." Only one of Bravo's platoon squads had fit in the shuttle, but 20 men in battle armor could put on an impressive show.
"Sending you our locations and every one of the Terrans we've bounced off," the Black Ops officer replied. "We're pushing them back so far, but they've got a lot of station to play with. I think we pulled decent schematics before they shut down the network in our area."
Edvard nodded absently, forgetting that Riley couldn't see him as he reviewed the schematics. His first two platoons had hit both of the station's docking bays, as those were the easiest place to land 7 shuttles worth of Marines. The resistance they'd run into so far had been unfocused, station security and Marines hitting the attackers from whatever angle they were coming from with whatever gear they had. But the defenders had only learned they were under attack at all a few minutes earlier. Resistance would